Saturday morning. This is Mary Cambeck. I'm the interviewer, and I'm with Carrie Lund at her Point Breeze home in Pittsburgh. The date is April 6, 2002. And the purpose of this interview is to talk about the United Farm Workers Grape Boycott and to have Carrie ask her to share some of her experiences on the boycott with us in Pittsburgh. She was very active in the boycott, and I will point out that there is a previous relationship between the narrator and the interviewer, and that we've known each other for a long time and you know, consider ourselves friends. And the first thing I have to do, Carrie, is just ask you for your consent in doing this tape, and is that okay?
That is okay.
Okay, thank you.
You have my consent.
Thank you. And this morning we'll be talking again about the boycott, and I'd like to begin, Carrie, by just asking you to talk a little bit about yourself in terms of your history and what background you think would be useful so that if somebody, somebody listens to the tape, they would have a little bit of an idea about who you are and maybe perhaps some of your interests and what you've been doing in the years then and since.
Briefly, right?
Oh, wait, as long as you'd like.
Okay. I'm 62 now, and I'm trying to think of aspects of my background which would be interesting or relevant. I grew up in D.C., I grew up in Canada, and I spent some time in South America. And when I lived in Canada, my grandmother, who was from Atlanta, would come and visit us and tell us stories about her growing up. And because she came from a wealthy political family, and her father was a politician, I heard kind of rather more than if her background had been other. And I remember her talking to me about her childhood and her experiences with her family and experiences particularly with the black people who were their servants. And some of the things she said made me very uncomfortable, and I didn't talk about it with her or my mother, but she would say things like, in the good old days when the Negras, as she put it, knew their place. And I was thinking, that doesn't sound right. What's that about? Also, although our lives and households and stuff, you wouldn't exactly call the rich and famous, my stepfather had a job with the Foreign Service from England, and we had live-in servants when I was growing up. And I noticed that nobody else had living servants living in their house, and I would never invite my friends home unless it was their day off, because I found this embarrassing somehow. And I also noticed that they would talk about kind of the cultural preferences of the live-in servants, particularly the ones who were French-Canadian in background, as they would refer to their music that they liked as main music. That didn't sound right. I didn't think that was very polite, but not that this is relevant or anything, but our cook was the only one who subscribed to a paper, and if I wanted to read the comics, I had to behave myself with her. I remember this. So when I was littler, I had a nurse in Montreal because my parents had to entertain a lot, and my mother was used to, that was the way you brought up people, that she was not black. Probably was because we were in Montreal, but my mother also had a conscience and had more awareness than a lot of people would have from her background. And I think she wanted to get away from some of the habits of her childhood, not because she didn't appreciate black people, but because she just wanted to break some of the habits that had been. I also lived in South America, going there when I was 12 and living there for a couple of years. By then, my stepfather was the British ambassador, and boy, did we have live-in servants. And I was very close to most of them, and we would talk a lot. I would give them English lessons, and they would give me Spanish lessons. And because it was like an open brick patio part of the back of the house, sometimes I'd roller skate through that part of the house. Mm-hmm. And they were very kind to me. And at one point, I helped mediate some labor problems with one of them who wanted child. She wanted to come back, and they were very eager to have her back. But although what I was learning was something about class realities, I didn't experience it as that then. I just experienced it as people, not something I was spectacularly talented with, but it was just kind of natural because I didn't have my nose in the air.
No, that's really interesting in terms of the background. So you really were around a lot of places before you were
I was around
in the
some
US,
places
a lot of
before
countries.
I settled in eventually back in the States.
Okay, well, no, this thanks for sharing that, because that really gives a good background to see how you got involved in this. And that was the next thing I was going to ask you, if you have memories about how you first got involved in the Great Boycott, which I've just put the years about 1967 to 1970 as the time, sort of the main time of the Great Boycott. And do you have any memories about what first moved you to become involved in that right here in Pittsburgh?
Well, when I lived in New York, which I did for a while, a close friend of mine was involved with the Catholic Worker on some levels, and I started subscribing to it, though I wasn't around it at all. And those were the days when Dorothy Day would go off to jail, and I think my friend Anne went off to jail with her. She was an artist. And, you know, once you subscribe to the Catholic Worker, I mean, I still have it come to the house now. You can't get away from it.
Yes.
So it's followed me everywhere. And living in Pittsburgh, I was living in the suburbs in the South Hills at the time, and I thought, where did all the Freedom Riders go? You know, I felt very removed from what had been interest in some of the things I had done, though I hadn't been on the Freedom Rides. I was living with my intensely Southern grandmother, and I think I was too chicken to go, frankly. But, you know, and read everything in the Catholic Worker, and that totally prepared me for stuff about the Great Boycott, because it was written about in there.
Right, yeah.
And I remember being at the Friends Meeting House after Martin Luther King died in 1968, and somebody came in and with a lot of excitement talked about the boycotters were here. And so I didn't waste much time contacting them and seeing what I could do to help. And it was a very kitchen table sort of revolution, as it were. You'd show up there for dinner, you'd take some food. One of my kids was really little at that point, I just had two. And we became close friends with the Rojas family then.
Oh, okay.
And Debbie and my the eldest daughter there, and my eldest daughter Barbara would play together, and Debbie'd come over for overnight, and Barbara'd go over there, and that's the kind of family relationship it really was.
Okay, so it started out right away as being a personal relationship.
Yes.
With the family. And at the time, do you remember about how old you were at that point in time, about 1967 to 70, 20s or 30s?
Born in 40, let's say, let's do the math. Late 20s, I guess.
Okay, so at that time, let's say you could probably younger in the scale of ages then. And when in terms of along with the personal relationship you had with the Rojases, did you have a particular role, let's say politically, that you remember? Did you actively picket, make phone calls, speak to groups about the boycott, or all of the above, or many of these things you consider part of the things that you did to help?
Though I'm quite a blabber, I'm really not much of a speaker.
Uh-huh.
And it's always been difficult for me to utilize either my strength of opinion or my grasp of facts in what I regarded as an effective way. So I didn't do speaking. Mm-hmm. But yes, I did picketing. And we had a thing that we would do out in the South Hills. And it was interesting. I remember one of our first orientations to going out and doing this was at Friends Meeting House. And, you know, it was like, they brought their culture. It was really strong, you know. So we'd have prayers, we'd have hymns, we'd have all this God stuff. And I was really not there at the time, nor was my husband. But, you know, I knew enough to behave myself, unlike some people who come and kind of turn their noses up and say, I can't do this, and
go
away.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But one of the people who was helping us be oriented was a Pittsburgher, a black man. I don't remember his name, but I remember him saying, you are going out to the master of slaves in the South Hills. Mm-hmm. Don't expect not to be spat on. Don't expect not to be harassed and insulted in the very least.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember we would go marketing, and we would have at some point these little tiny stickers that would just fit where the prices went.
Right.
And you'd take a can of something, and you'd leave a sign that said, "Don't buy grapes."
Oh, okay.
That was really cool.
It's like a sort of guerrilla warfare in the grocery store.
Yeah,
so
and
that
I remember
was,
at some point.
Yeah.
I remember at some point demonstrating in Market Square, and there I could actually do a little indoctrinating or preaching. You know, yell about how hard it was for the workers in the fields. Yell about what it was like. You know, for them who were harvesting all our food to be treated the way they were, and we didn't even think about it ever, you know. And it was very therapeutic, actually, very cathartic, to, you know, just put that out there. So I did lots of little things. I did voting, I did picketing, I did spaghetti
right
dinners, which I would then take on the bus over to the north side. One day I remember it spilled all over the place. Childcare,
right?
Whatever. Oh. If I realized how hard Elena's work was about feeding her family every day and all of us who turned up, I would have done a lot more cooking.
So in terms of everybody just becoming like sort of an extended family, that became part of the boycott. So.
And sometimes Caesar would come through town and we all sit around and talk about that real excitedly.
Yeah. That's the big visit everybody waited for.
And when we went up to New York, we'd go over and see Dolores Huerta, you know, in Brooklyn.
Right. Okay, no, that's those are great memories because you obviously recall a lot of the, you know, sort of the small things that sort of made the atmosphere. And what affiliation would best describe you at that time? Would you say you were part of student and faculty groups, a member of a religious faith community or congregation, a union member, or political activist, or maybe more than one of these fits you?
I have always been a major political gadfly.
Okay, so that's your, you felt comfortable in that.
I
did. That role, you know. Oh, great. Well, the other thing, I was going to talk about the Rojas family. You've already talked about their personal relationship, which everyone had to some extent, but in your case, it seems, you know, it was a lot, you know, more personal. And do you remember, since you've already had experience with other cultures, and if you were in South America, you clearly had met Latinos before they came. But did you remember your first impression of the Rojas family when they came, like, initially? You said your daughter became friends with the oldest girl, Debbie, but do you remember being... That is like a specific experience in terms of boycott of having a Chicano family coming to Pittsburgh?
No. I was aware for myself that Pittsburgh was not exactly what you'd call a Latin-friendly place, and I often missed the atmosphere that could give.
Oh, that's interesting.
The city.
Yeah.
I mean, I lived close to New Yorkan and Puerto Rican neighborhoods when I lived in New York. And I remember my grandmother was very uptight about them all because, of course, they were all painted as dangerous, dark desperados.
Mm-hmm.
I just missed the music, the food, and, you know, my political experiences in South America. But I knew that for them it was really a change. And I remember Elena talking about Caesar saying, "Oh, it's just a little Pennsylvania mining town," bursting
right
through the Liberty Tubes or the other things onto the bridge. Their first view of Pittsburgh was really kind of a shock,
right?
And I could really identify with that.
Yeah, just coming completely. That's an interesting story about being told really nobody had any idea what they were getting into when they came here.
I knew they were living on $5 a week,
right,
as their pay, and I knew that rather quickly some people with some degree of means hooked up with them and made it a little bit easier, like the Trachtenbergs, for example.
Well, that's a good example that people really came forward right away to assist them, because that was part of the, well, as we all knew, the $5 a week was something that they stuck to for probably many years, you know, in terms of, you know, the salary and sort of following the Catholic worker thing of the voluntary poverty. I know that's come up. You know, and when people write about this, they mention that. So, when you think back and knowing Albert and Elena, did you have, and this obviously would be looking back, did you feel that they had different roles? And did you want to say something about how you felt what Albert's role was and Elena's role, and if it changed or what seemed to be true at that time, you know, sort of looking backwards on it?
Let me see, 68. the women's movement was coming up, but no, I didn't think about it a whole lot, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, who knew, really,
right,
to what degree sexism was embedded in our culture. Albert, I remember him teasing what was probably Desiree, you know, when she would she was very, very little, and she would sometimes pull her shirt up, and he'd tease her in a way that made me uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
He'd say things like, oh, sexy mama or something, and I thought, well, maybe this is okay there, but it doesn't feel okay to me,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of thing. But he seemed, you know, he seemed at the time to be a participating member of the family, you
right.
know, really uh-huh. very family-oriented and stuff. The one thing Elena did that made me a little uncomfortable then, though I knew, again, you know, I was dealing with what was important to her in another culture, and I was impressed with how strongly they held on to overt experiences of that, was if they come over for dinner, she'd always say to the kids, say, thank you, Jesus, and I'd say, how about thank you, Carrie, I cooked.
Okay, so there was an experience of the cultural experience, their cultural experiences and
yeah.
yours, as not just a Pittsburgh person, but obviously someone who's traveled around. Well, thanks for sharing that, because that's, really gives a good insight into that. And the boycott community, who worked with, of course, you would consider yourself part of that. Did you start to know any members of the community in the boycott you had not run into before, or groups of people that you normally wouldn't have come across or worked with before that time that you
were Dave Horowitz, the Trachtenberg family,
mm-hmm.
You know, various of the people who were involved.
Right.
Phyllis Wetaby.
Uh-huh. So this was these were all folks you had not
met previously.
Yeah. Okay, no, thanks. And if just dividing this people who worked on it sort of arbitrarily as students and labor union members and political and religious activists, did your opinion of any of these groups change over time that you might remember, like when you started, you might have had one impression, either positive or negative, either way that might have changed that you recall now?
It's interesting because I think I thought of union people before Caesar as Jimmy Hoffa.
Oh, okay.
And I'm very ambivalent about the labor community. I think they've gotten too greedy, too hoggy. I like the idea,
right.
but the reality is not lived out in a pretty way at all.
Okay.
Especially here. But it did take me, eventually I was to study war labor history,
mm-hmm.
and there were tons of people just so in love with it at that point. I just ended up loving the idea that people would stand up against oppression.
Mm-hmm.
But Caesar really changed my mind about the labor community for a long, long time.
Oh, okay.
And I remember Albert coming in and saying, these people are going to support us, these people are interested. I do remember one thing. At the time, my ex-husband and I lived in Dorbot, which is pretty working class community, or was at the time. And a brother of one of our neighbors who was close with us worked two jobs, worked on one of the river boats, you know, driving
uh-huh,
coal
right.
up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was off, he worked at a blind processing factory. And he was sort of a person who was very emotional. And I remember once that first summer, he would say to the cook on his riverboat, well, since you carry grapes, here's what I'm going to do with my share. And he picked up a big handful or two of grapes and dumped them into the river.
Oh, okay.
I thought that was very nice.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting, both for me, my ex-husband, and various people who came close to it, though, to see how we picked up on it, what the parts of this that were hard for us.
Right.
Because here we were, you know, these semi-upper middle class Anglos, Gringos, whatever.
Right.
Struggling with a culture which had no intention of muting its style for our comfort.
Right.
And that was as it should be. Mm-hmm. But it was very challenging sometimes.
Oh, that's interesting, because those are some of the things that I was hoping to discuss, and I'm, you know, happy you're getting into it, because that's a real, you know, in terms of looking back over the experience, those are things that are really, you know, valuable. And now, you're still in Pittsburgh, so I'm wondering if you met people during that time Are you still acquainted or work with people you met there for the first time now, like, you know, 30 years later in Pittsburgh? Would you say
my ex-husband had a pretty strong friendship with Dave Horowitz, and we started going to him for our glasses.
Oh, okay.
He's an optometrist. And his daughter is also an optometrist, and she and I also took some classes at Pitt together. So despite the fact that she's very busy, we still see each other sometimes and talk a lot when I go see her for my glasses. With her kids, with her interest in education and rising interest in politics, she doesn't have much spare time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we're still close. The Trachtenbergs, I think, all went to California.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Phyllis is too busy to ever have anything to do with unless you're supporting the same candidate at the same time.
So in terms of really the personal friendships are what you remember, and the political maybe not
so
important.
I think
I
may have gotten Molly involved in it at that point, because during those years, we took turns kind of pulling each other into whatever project we were doing.
Right. So that's a I would say, positive experience for you in terms of just having the friendships last.
Yeah.
Now, after the Great Boycott ended, there was a period of time between that and the lettuce boycott, and there was another Mexican-American family, the Valencias, who came along with, as I remember, probably 5 or 6 Anglo volunteers for a period of time. And do you remember whether you continued your involvement during the lettuce boycott, or did it?
I remember
sort
that
of
I didn't.
Yes.
And let me go back just a little bit. I remember one other thing that happened while we were involved with that phase of the Great Boycott. My ex-husband went down to the city county building for something, and he had our daughter, our younger daughter, on his shoulders. And there were all these flags in the city county building. And Freya looked up and said, "Don't buy grapes! Don't buy grapes!" Which I thought was kind of wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And I also remember being at my parents' house in somewhere near the Catskills that summer, and hearing over the radio that the boycott had been successful.
Right. Uh-huh.
Just it being a big thrill in my life. By the time they got to the lettuce boycott, I thought,
Right.
I hadn't had grapes in years.
Right.
I don't think I could do this, even though I wasn't much of a salad fan. So I never met the Valencias that I recall.
Okay. So that was that experience. We'll say that this was sort of the end in terms of the farm workers.
Yeah.
Now during the boycott, there were a few sort of communities I was just going to talk to you about, and there were frequent leafletings, money collections, and
could you turn your things down for a second?
Sure. Okay. Just moving. Talking about some of the communities that. We're involved in the boycott. I was just going to move a little bit into the labor community, even though you've talked about it. During the time of the Great Boycott, there were, as a fundraising effort, there were some leafletings and money collections at plant gates, at steel mills, and these were all about 5 a.m. They were before dawn, and I'm wondering if you remember, I know you had a family then, so probably the answer is self-evident, but I'm wondering if you ever went on those that were really early in the morning, and basically, they were fundraising.
I went on at least one.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I remember.
Do you remember the reception that the boycotters, and I would say that's the Rojas plus the supporters, got when they were at the plant gates?
Well, people scream in and out pretty quick at those situations.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like kids let out of school. And not really well, but I remember there wasn't a lot of negativity. And
okay.
Some people took the flyers.
Okay, so it was like, so you felt it was a positive experience in terms of what...
And I want to go back just a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
There was a couple who was here then, Kay and Walter Tillo.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we got to be very close friends with them, and it did, you know, keep our political thing going in that way for a while. And, you know, I tried to talk to Walter a little bit, because they were like so, so pro-union, you know,
right.
What it was all about. And I did eventually, when I had my third child, leave a space open in hospital visiting for Kay to come in and organize if she could as a visitor.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, that's really good.
Much calmer now than it was then.
Yes.
The people who could come in and not be, you had 2 visitors then.
So, well, so you use the your personal time to sort of have some political action going on. Well, that was really forward thinking in terms of, you know, having them come visit. And you mentioned how you felt about the union people before. Was this the first time you had really worked with union members on a project formally?
Yes, and it wasn't always great, I'll tell you.
Okay. So this was the first time. Do you want to talk about that at all? And
I remember going somewhere with Albert, and I can't remember right now where it was, but I was just kind of, everybody seemed like, you know, a good old boy, stodgy and right. interested in what was in it for them at all points.
So that was your initial impression, right? Okay, yeah, no, thanks.
I haven't known very many radical union people, quite frankly.
Okay.
Probably as much on me as it was on them. But I occasionally do unity little things here. I'll turn up for a picket line or a rally or
something. Well, something. Living Wage Campaign, I think, is a present.
Busy in there.
Yeah, that's I think right now in Pittsburgh, that's would be what's attracting people who would be interested in these issues would be, probably some
shot down by as many people who can find things to shoot at.
Oh, okay. That's interesting to know. Because there's lots of buttons right now with people, people are wearing on that campaign. do you offhand remember the names of any of the unions in Pittsburgh that were prominent in working on the boycott offhand? Or?
Nope.
In terms of the union, no, you don't. I was going to say some of the unions are like the steelworkers, obviously, have lost many members since then because the steel industry has sort of collapsed here. And going on from the labor community, the religious community, you've touched on this already. Would you describe yourself as having any religious affiliation at that time of the boycott, if you remember back then?
This is going to sound a little strange, but that's okay. I've always had religious affiliation or non-affiliation, as the case may be. But I remember my grandmother who had Mary Baker Eddy,
right,
was our cousin.
Oh, okay.
I never met her, of course.
Yes.
My grandmother saying to Dick, who was my husband at the time, before we got married, she said, "Watch out for her. Periodically, she gets religion." My grandmother wasn't your typical church lady.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember when this happened. I think it was before the boycott. But when I came from New York, I think I've always really considered, although it isn't, New York my hometown. And when I was there, my friends were Jewish, and I didn't even know anyone else was there.
Right.
And I spent a lot of time studying Jewish history,
okay,
trying to study Hebrew. Mm-hmm. I even subscribed to the Jerusalem Post Weekly so I could take their lessons.
Oh, too. Oh,
and
okay.
It was printed really hard to read, not only being in a totally different language. Mm-hmm. But when I came here, I was surrounded by so many religious-affiliated people. I finally got fed up with it.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And I would occasionally carry signs saying, you know, pagans for peace or something.
Yeah.
But it was just kind of like a semi-joke. I just got tired of being surrounded by Presbyterians.
Oh, okay.
Who else was around?
Right. That you feel that that's a Pittsburgh sort of religious
at
thing.
At the time.
A lot of Presbyterians.
Quite a few Catholics, too. I did notice that.
Okay.
But I didn't, really. And my ex-husband was half Jewish. His mother came from Israel. He was not even remotely interested in any of this. We did eventually, after Martin Luther King, go to Quaker meeting for a while, but it made me nervous.
Oh, okay. So that was, let's say, mixed feelings for you.
Yeah.
But in the boycott, since you remember, you met other people who were in it, do you recall, just off the top of your head, names or remember just the presence of other religious people, people who would be ministers, priests, rabbis,
oh, yes,
nuns, Quaker activists?
Tons.
Okay, so.
Many.
Okay,
and
so
I mean, we had already started taking, grown-out kids the clothes of the kids that they could no longer fit it over to O'Malley's house.
Oh, okay.
Or mm-hmm, his church, because largely because it was Manchester at the time.
Right.
And, we knew people. I mean, I met Don.
McElveen? Don Fisher, right.
No, I didn't meet Fisher for quite a while. And Joe Hughes, not priest. And
right.
He was out with all the basketball stars and sports stars who happened to be Catholic priests.
Okay,
and
so that was pretty much, that was a presence that you remember. And you may not want to comment on this, but what about the religious groups who might have been supporting the boycott then? Do you have any feeling, especially like on the living wage, because you have some contact now with religious groups, do you think they're as likely to support labor activities now as they were then? And do you have any opinion about that, that they might or they might not? Or
the religious people I mostly remember were really involved in things like trying to desegregate.
Okay.
South Hills more than
okay.
And
that was
I
a bigger.
I still kept a little bit of distance between me and religious groups during the boycott because, as Jody used to put it, you hang out with the snakes, you get bit. And I'll tell you off the record later just how that developed for me.
Okay.
But there was a lot of religion around, I'll tell you. And I did my best to be accepting and supportive.
Right.
You know, I don't even like the
distance.
Word tolerant because it sounds so
patronizing or something. Like that. Mm-hmm.
But even more than me, Dick, who didn't like to hang around overtly religious people, they were cool, most of them, and he was comfortable with it.
So maybe it was
I
a particular.
I give him more marks than me.
Oh, okay.
I'm used to having a very diverse past.
Oh, okay. No, that's interesting because bringing that, I mean, that's obviously a whole other experience in Pittsburgh that you brought to it. Okay, well, in the women's issues, I had a few questions if you'd like to, you know, explore that a little bit. As you mentioned, the women's issues were just really starting to become prominent in the consciousness of activists and citizens, probably sort of at the same time or like slightly afterwards. And I'm wondering if you were personally involved in any of the groups then supporting new definitions of women's roles, and did that continue, or were you was that more part of your consciousness than maybe some other folks?
Later, at the time, when the first women's thing that I remember happening here, I know how typical that could be, was a group of people calling themselves the Women's Liberation Front. What did we do for our first action? We read the names of the Vietnamese war dead males in Mellon Park downtown.
Oh, really? So that was
called a women's thing.
Right.
Something in my mind said, okay, but isn't there something more women oriented we could do with this?
Oh, okay. So that was that's
Ruth
interesting.
Jones at all?
Yes.
I remember doing it with her.
So that was like one of the first probably political women's things that were happening.
Yeah.
It actually was more political, I guess, in terms of, you know, what was going on in the world and particularly just the women's issue. So you already felt like there was something needed to be addressed above and beyond what
I
was starting.
Yeah, I think so. And I was reading about things like stuff in the Black Civil Rights things where there was already those things happening at SNCC and Stokely Carmichael with his wonderful phrase, the women's position in the movement is prone, and Casey Hayden and various other people. I also remember somewhat after that, I think, although, you know, as the years roll by, it's kind of hard to keep it in a framework of from here to then.
Right.
You know, through my university connections, I was in a women's consciousness raising group, many of whose members were not American.
Okay.
And that was interesting. All white, yes, but not American.
Okay. No, that's a bit. And then your interest continued beyond, you know, the boycott situation. But at the time of the boycott, do you feel that issue was not a major issue in terms of how people worked together in the boycott?
I understand from Elena's visit last year,
right,
that there were many things I was not aware of.
Okay.
Many things I did not see.
So that was
but
a concern, but for the people who were around
her experience when she returned, I think, than when she was here, but I'm not sure.
So in some of this, situations might be more retrospective in that what we felt, let's say what people felt comfortable with, there may have been other things going on, but for all intents and purposes, it was not a major issue in the boycott
I'd say for you. I
didn't
see it if it was.
Okay. No, that's,
because
most
of the women I knew were outspoken and
didn't have that was not a major concern for them right then.
Their own persons. And,
right.
You know, that's exactly
pretty comfortable.
Two steps behind.
Okay, thank you. So it's fair to say that maybe some of the concerns were looking back later on as more than the experience
that's
right here in this city.
That's
right. Thank you for that insight here. I have a question about a couple of conflicts that arose that you may or may not have comments on. One thing that happened during the boycott is that there was a major civil rights initiative in Pittsburgh, the Black Construction Coalition, where the movement attempted to integrate the building trades, which were already unionized, and of course the unionized people were supporting the boycott. And during that campaign, which got a lot of publicity, there were thousands of people demonstrating and hundreds who were arrested, and I'm wondering if you remember this.
Oh, yes,
prominent.
I was there.
Okay, so I was going to ask the next question, were you personally involved in that?
Walking across the bridge with Jim Stevens at my side.
Okay.
And though he wasn't really Tim Stevens yet, he was on his way.
Okay, so.
And my ex-husband was arrested in that.
Okay.
He had the first arrest in the
Bible. Oh, so, oh, okay. So that
and
was
Dave
the first
Horowitz
time.
Was involved. I remember him trying to name it White Jock Straps for the Black Construction Coalition.
Okay, and in terms of that, being involved in it, people were involved as citizens, but also, of course, if they were working on the boycott, they would have been identified with the farm workers. And in fact, during some of those days, some of the demonstrators carried boycott farm worker signs, which, of course, the unionized building trades people who were really being protested saw, and they saw these supporters, obviously, criticizing them. Do you remember that at all, that there was might have been some people unhappy with the fact that the farm workers were very vocal now?
I don't remember that. Could have happened. I just don't remember it.
Right. But mostly, you would say your participation was as a civil rights person, as a citizen. That would have not been the major point. Okay.
Yeah.
And then another conflict which happened during the boycott was that when Cesar Chavez came to Pittsburgh, there were demonstrations in the produce yards downtown when, where the grapes came in. And there had been a conflict sort of brewing for a while where there were some individuals who were identified as members of the Communist Party, either by themselves or others, who had been asked to leave the lines in deference to some demands of people who were not comfortable with that. And at one point, when one of the women was asked to leave the line, there were many supporters who had already planned to drop their flags and protest and leave the line. And I'm wondering if you remember that specific incident now. And did you ever hear about it? Did you know that was brewing or that was somewhat of a problem? Okay, so
no.
For you, that was not a major issue in terms of...
I could have used more education at the time about solidarity, and I think my comprehension of things like that wasn't as strong as it could be. I remember having one meeting early. We always, you see, at the little meetings, we always sang,
okay.
Which was great. But I remember some of us singing Solidarity Forever for the Union makes us weak because we're all really tired.
Not strong, as the song
exactly.
goes.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's...
And the little fissures and cracks that happened, I wasn't that aware of them.
Right. And this would not have been a major factor for you either way in terms of some people who were upset
about it.
Okay, so that was not,
I don't know.
Well, this was one particular situation, so obviously this is not something that everyone was aware of, but
I feel like
it's useful to see.
Because there's
things that some people were, let's say there's issues that some people are more concerned about, and this helps to surface, some things that people remember, and for a lot of people, there were, these were not major
it
things.
It was pretty clear to me. And by the end of the Great Boycott, although I can't remember him talking about that,
right.
But for Dick, this could come as an impediment to his career on some level.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that it was
things did eventually become impediments to his career, but that wasn't, he didn't say that at that time. I remember he was, Pip has had a day off for Martin Luther King Day forever.
Okay.
And I remember at the time he was really resentful of it, and I was really shocked. But it felt to me like family involvement in things like this was like trickling.
Okay, I see. And so there's some very real repercussions that over time people might have
over
been more concerned.
Long time, because I wasn't aware
that they weren't.
I went on doing things, but he wasn't around to do them much anymore. He
okay. So people made decisions
and
maybe
I would take
to pull
the kids
back.
With me if they weren't in school.
Okay, So these started affecting people in their personal life maybe a little bit more as time went on. So, but thanks for sharing that, because that's a whole other consideration of how these sort of affect, people personally. And I know I was going to ask you a little bit about some of the religious symbols, and you've already touched on that about not being comfortable. And one of the things that I would pick out two prominent symbols were with the flag, the Wailuka flag with the Thunderbird, and also the Virgin of Guadalupe, which is sort of a cultural symbol for the Mexican Americans. And do you remember that those were included in, you do remember that it was very much part of marches?
I wasn't comfortable with that, although I think I just sort of pretended the Virgin of Guadalupe wasn't around.
Okay.
Perhaps, but I mean the farmer's flag buttons.
Okay.
Were
so they were a cultural
cool.
symbol in that you, so even if that you didn't share that, you saw that as part of their cultural thing,
wore,
and as you
I
said before.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who
who did it in those days?
Right, because that's true. There were many symbols.
I probably had a bumper sticker if we had them.
So that, did you see that as important in terms of the religious imagery and the prayer service, and you say the hymns that happened with boycott activities? Do you have any feeling about how maybe other groups, such as, well, you mentioned yourself and the student groups and union groups may have responded to that? You
I
said
think
you
for
weren't
a lot
quite.
Of people it may have been a turnoff, but you know what? I've never really appreciated that people just can't suck it up mostly. And yet, I've had points where I couldn't suck it up, you know.
Right. And for them, like you said before, their imagery, it was important to them. They came with that.
Right.
And that was part of them.
Groups very much.
Right. Okay.
And I do remember one couple who just like left the prayer before the demonstration saying, I can't do this.
Oh, okay. So you were aware of that, but for you, recognizing that as part of the people's experience was
right.
Okay. Okay. Well, no, thanks a lot. In looking back over your experience, we're just going to, you know, talk about a few things to sort of wind down, but give you a chance to share some of yours. Would you say on the whole this was a positive experience? Yes. And that you felt it really helped them in terms of, well, it aside from the fact that I think we can safely say the grapes were stopped.
There was a lot more hands on and feet on than a lot of things had been since I missed Mother Jones, since I missed, certain other things that have happened in the country's history.
So this was something that probably one of the major, would you say it's one of the major political things that you had done that really, Now, one thing that might be sort of the fun part, the interview, do you have any favorite stories or a story or something that sticks in your mind?
I told them all, yeah.
Well, it's a chance to get, talk about anything that sort of stood out as a memory for you, looking back, obviously, that you might tell other people that that you went through yourself.
I think Chris throwing the grapes into the river.
I think just
how, my interest, I can remember standing in front of Rockwell when we were putting a little pressure on Rockwell over the years, and I would stand there outside the building, and I would look up to it, and I would try to sort of get a fix on the people in the office to crack the walls around their minds and hearts.
Right.
I would try and beam up messages of, how about looking at it our way for a little while? How about looking at the dangers to the world, the environment, the culture, the country, the people? So I think other than victories, role modeling, like Caesar replaced Jimmy Hoffa as a young member in my mind for a long time, I'm interested in how people are affected. If they're not directly affected, how they get drawn in and how they make this part of their ethics, their ethos, their life, But I am not someone who's like 24/7 activist. I'm not.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I was also very, very involved with the South African thing for a long time. I was saying something to Molly about that the other day, and she said, well, you don't always stay with projects forever, but I know you never lose or caring about them.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of tells me also how it is for me, and I remember trying to write about this, but there was just so many layers, so much complications, so much, not necessarily in terms of the great boycott, but everything.
Yeah.
And now I come to understand it a little bit better. There was a young couple who I met, who I think were first friends of Frank, Flo and Jim's, who were involved in this for a bit. And we were kind of all friends together, and then they broke up, and I became friends with the wife. But she said to me, in a way it's wrong for you to be involved in civil rights issues because it doesn't directly affect you. And I said, I don't agree at all.
Right.
We talked about that. But it's just kind of like you don't want to be a dilettante totally. It's just like, ow, sorry. How your actions become part of your whole life, but don't have to necessarily take it totally over at all times.
You make judgments in terms of what, well, probably that would be an experience shared with people over time, exactly how much energy and time you put into this. But and we're just talking about some of the stories, talking about civil rights, you mentioned, as someone who's really had experience with the civil rights movement, that time that the boycott happened was a time when there was more of the black nationalist feeling and the black power and white people not feeling quite accepted. Do you think that there was a tendency for people to feel a little more comfortable in the boycott, as opposed to maybe some of the black civil rights organizations at that time that may have been a reason why people might have been active in that, or does that not, think that didn't enter the equation for people to make those distinctions? In other words, it's a civil rights issue, but the black movement was probably much, we could safely say they were more...
in your face.
Yeah, it was a little bit harder to be participating in that at that time in Pittsburgh, let's say, than maybe this movement, so that people felt they could really help without getting involved in some of that. Or do you think that wasn't primarily an issue here for people like yourself? It just came at the
so
that
hard
time.
To say. You know, it's like, that's why I said history can only, and that's somebody else's quote, but you understand backwards. I don't know. I think the great boycotts were very much a culture of brown-skinned people.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But they were needing
right,
our
yeah.
participation mm-hmm. in a way that the Black Civil Rights Power Movement kind of exploded in so many directions at the same time.
Okay, it's a good point. Yeah.
And a lot of people, you know, it's interesting. I've taken courses in this because my stuff at Pitt, I took, by and large, black history, women's history, labor history.
Okay.
And there was one teacher who I still see from time to time, named Larry Glasgow, who said in his class, in a kind of felt demeaning way, well, you know, all these women, white women, were taking off their clothes, you know, to join the march workers, and you know, he's talking
right.
about, like
mm-hmm.
I said, I think I stood up and I said, Larry, we would have taken off our skin
yeah.
if there had been a way to do it.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, to try to redress some of the insanities and people's inhumanity to people. But along with the rapid growth, which then stalled out in some ways, of the Black Power Movement came the lashbacks, I don't even want to call it that. But you know, white people, the more exaggerated thing of white people feeling that, hey, I wasn't even born then, and we're not at fault, and what about our rights? And you
okay,
know,
right.
the back room,
mm-hmm.
too. So, mm-hmm. after you leave, I will probably achieve a little more clarity on this point.
Oh, no, that sounds fine.
I will probably
fine.
Have more
that
good stories
fine,
and
yeah.
questions, but right this minute, it's just like...
That's not, yeah.
I
no,
can,
I,
no,
I,
no,
that's
I
a
no,
good
no,
observation.
No, I'm not
yeah.
saying that it's not my focus. I'm just saying, like, the dust of the millennia just comes up and shaking out this carpet.
Who is finishing up talking about some of the civil rights issues that were involved in the boycott. And I'm just wondering, Kara, if you can sort of mention, in terms of when we put the tape back in, some of the things that you said about how this was involved with the, you know, civil rights movement, that you were particularly interested in that for yourself and who you read. And I'm assuming this, you know, I think this connects with the
experience. My great-grandfather disfranchised the black people in his state in Georgia.
Oh, okay.
He got his second term as I don't even know what. He had lots of jobs.
Okay.
And he has his own footnote, W.E.B. Du Bois.
Oh, really? Okay.
His biography, which said,
maybe you'd mentioned the person's name, because that is...
Oh, his name was Hope Smith.
Okay.
And he was Secretary of the Interior to Cleveland, and he was blah, 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 what else? I think he was a senator twice. And... W.E.B. Du Bois said, and I'm surprised they included it, frankly, but I'm glad
mm-hmm.
they did, that he had a brilliant mind, but he sold out.
Oh,
he
okay.
Said, yeah. I mean, he didn't say sold out.
Yes.
He said, yeah. When I discovered this, I thought, shit, you know, it's not, I mean, there was so much, you recall, I'm sure, how much palaver and browbeating and soul-wrenching and all this shit went on. It still goes on
mm-hmm.
to this day. About what people did when, and you know, I was accused of being so riddled with guilt. Well, who the hell would be A and B? I didn't feel. I felt bad.
Right.
I didn't. I don't know if I felt guilty, but I felt that I had some responsibility
mm-hmm.
to try and redress some stuff. Now, because of some of the things that happened to me growing up. I didn't live up to my promise. as a mm-hmm. possible scholar or activist, but I have done things, as you have noted. Little-ish things, like I've supported some women, black candidates, by doing their laundry that they didn't have time to do.
Okay.
I have supported close friends by looking after their two children when they
right.
were running for city council.
Mm-hmm.
So I have done things that are very unsung, but I did them.
Right.
I was involved in various ways. One of the people I studied with at Pitt, I think I took one of her husband's courses and two courses with the woman who was also teaching. They were married to each other. And when the guy found out, because she told him about me, she said, "What happened to all the money in your family?"
Oh.
I thought,
yeah.
Well, you know.
Not something you were particularly interested in?
It wasn't that I was interested in or not, but it's not something I'd ever thought about.
Right.
And I felt kind of like, I need to explain this to this guy, but I didn't know about it all
right.
that much, you know. But I felt it was a proper question. It was rude.
Yes, I was going to say
that. It was confrontational,
yeah. uh-huh.
but it was real.
That was the person who was hearing you was hearing something else than you were, than your interest in it was,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, but it's kind of like, oh, duh, you know. Putting this together with that together with this together. I mean, one of the people I studied with at Pitt said, there is a, at the time, which was like several years ago, there are some people who are still alive today who were alive during slavery.
Mm.
And I remember when I took all these courses in Black Studies, I felt I could look over my shoulder just a teeny weeny bit, not even all the way mm-hmm. around, and feel those people and see those people.
Okay.
And be with mm-hmm. those people. Because it wasn't that far away. I mean, the woman I lived with for 5 years, and people I know today, did day work in wealthy women's houses.
Right.
You know?
Okay. Yeah.
So, it's still with us.
Well, it's interesting that I would say that, you know, when people think of Pittsburgh, probably is this image of the immigrant industrial workers is still pretty much a predominant one. So your background is really totally different, coming from, you know, having Southern relatives and being in the political
service. Not ever living in the South. I only went there to marry my grandmother. But, you know, I mean, I took these courses at Pitt because I wanted to know, how did we get in this mess?
How did you, right, okay.
And, you know, I know all the stories of the people coming up on the railroad, and the black people, and in some cases walking
right
by the railroad
mm-hmm.
to get to north.
Right.
You know?
So that became, I mean, it's part of your experience. This is obviously much more important, perhaps, than
much
people who
important.
Might be involved. So, you know, that's it. But I really appreciate your sharing these stories. And say this is drawing the interview to an end with Carrie. And we are, once again, at Point Breeze at her home and in Pittsburgh. And it is April 6, 2002. And once again, thanks very much for calling up the memories.
The snow is falling and the trees are in full bloom.
That is right.
Yes. Yes.
The weather has been like that, even though it is April 6, 2002. Thanks a lot, Carrie.
Thank you, Barry.